Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Ashley tells us the latest news related to the Chinese company Huawei.
The founder of Chinese technology company Huawei said the United States' restriction on sales will have little effect on the company. He added that Huawei is discussing emergency relief from Google for possible loss of services for its smartphone business. Ren Zhengfei told Chinese state broadcaster CGTV, "The U.S. government's actions at the moment underestimate our capabilities." He said Huawei has supply backups if it cannot buy American parts. Last week, the U.S. ordered the ban and said Huawei was a security risk. American officials claimed Huawei would give information it collects to the Chinese government. Huawei has denied the accusation. Huawei is the world's second largest maker of smartphones, behind Korea's Samsung. It has developed its own chips for some smartphones and other products. But it depends on Google's Android operating system and American suppliers for more advanced parts for its products. Google said it would continue to support existing Huawei smartphones, but that future devices would not have some apps and services, including Maps, Gmail, and Search. Ren admitted that the loss of Google's services will be very big. He added, "We are discussing emergency relief measures." On Monday, U.S. officials gave Huawei a permit to buy U.S. goods until August 19th. The move is meant to give American businesses that use Huawei products some more time to make other plans. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman accused the United States of misusing state power to hurt foreign companies and interfere with the marketplace. In 2012, Huawei's U.S. sales collapsed after a congressional panel told businesses to avoid its products and those from another Chinese company, ZTE. However, Huawei's sales around the world rose quickly. Its smartphone shipments rose 50% compared to a year earlier in the first 3 months of 2019.
The average American gamer is 33 years old and likes to play video games on their smartphone. And the average gamer is spending on games more each year, 20% more than 1 year ago and 85% more than in 2015. That information comes from a report by the Entertainment Software Association, or ESA, a group that represents computer software and gaming companies. Ipsos, a market research company, questioned about 4,000 gamers for the ESA report. In the United States, more than 164 million people play video games. That represents nearly 65% of all U.S. adults. The most popular kind of game is the casual game, activities that have simple rules and do not require much time or skill. American consumers spent around $43.4 billion on gaming in 2018. Most of that money was used to buy games, not computer hardware or gaming accessories. The three most popular pay-to-play games were Call of Duty, Black Ops 3, Red Dead Redemption 2, and NBA 2K19. Games are striking an important chord with American culture, said Stanley Pierre-Louis, ESA's acting president. That's what makes it the leading form of entertainment today. More than three-fourths of those asked report that video games provide them with mental activity as well as an escape from work and other day-to-day pressures. About 46% of all U.S. gamers are female, although they often like different games than boys and men do. Americans will soon have even more ways to play video games. Two U.S.-based technology companies, Apple and Alphabet Inc.'s Google, have announced plans to launch game streaming services later this year. I'm Brian Lynn.
Every day, millions of students receive meals at schools across the United States. The National School Lunch Program is a federally assisted program that operates in public and nonprofit private schools. It provides meals to around 30 million children nationwide. About 20 million of the students meet requirements for a free lunch or light meal during the school day. About 2 million others qualify for a reduced price. They pay 40 cents a day for lunch. The nearly 8 million remaining students are charged the full price for their meals. But some of their parents may struggle to pay these costs. Over the years, U.S. schools have tried different methods to collect unpaid lunch money. But not all of these methods are popular. Rhode Island school officials learned recently that denying children a hot meal led to strong criticism on social media. Some parents had not paid lunch money for their children. So the school district had planned to serve the children cold sandwiches. But after receiving hundreds of comments on Facebook and angry telephone calls, the school district last week canceled the plan. Catherine Boning is with Warwick Public Schools, the district receiving the criticism. She told the Associated Press that the bad reaction to the sandwich plan was global. Such plans are not new, but they are increasingly facing public criticism. If a child is seen eating a cold meal, for example, it becomes clear who owes money and this can cause feelings of guilt or shame. The movement against lunch shaming is gaining popularity around the country.
In the past, Warwick students who owed lunch money were served cheese sandwiches that are not on the normal menu. School district officials wanted to make this less noticeable by changing to a kind of sandwich that is offered to everyone, Bonang explained. But criticism pushed officials to say all students would get the choice of a hot meal. A policy of not letting older students with unpaid fees take part in school trips, dances, or other activities was also recently stopped, the district said. It is difficult to know how common lunch shaming is among the nation's thousands of schools. But in 2011, most school districts had unpaid meal fees. That information comes from a study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, which supervises the federal school lunch program. Among those districts, schools often served alternative meals, such as sandwiches. Districts also reported taking other actions to collect money, such as not giving students their class marks.
New Mexico passed a law against such actions in 2017. Several other states have followed its example. They include California, Iowa, and Oregon. Their laws generally do not permit actions like making students do work around the school. Yet serving alternative meals is not always banned. Supporters of the law say students should never go hungry at school or be shamed with food. Last month, U.S. lawmakers proposed anti-lunch shaming bills to help protect children with unpaid fees. The USDA does not support actions that identify such students, but gives school districts permission to set their own policies. A child can feel shame even if other children do not know why they are getting a cold sandwich, said Jennifer Ramo. She is with an organization called New Mexico Appleseed. It works on improving the lives of poor people. After forgetting to pay lunch money for 1 week, one parent said her young son was given a sunflower butter sandwich last year. The mother said her heart broke when she picked him up at school and he asked why she had not paid. She was also charged $2.50 for the sandwich, the same price as for a hot meal. The woman lives in Cranston, Rhode Island, not far from Warwick. Cranston School District said it no longer serves alternative meals.
Reasons for unpaid fees can also be different. Some families may struggle to pay basic living costs, even if they do not qualify for free or reduced-priced lunches. Others may feel shame in applying for such meals or not realize they qualify. The School Nutrition Association represents lunchroom operators and suppliers. It says providing free lunches for all students would end questions about charges for meal money. The USDA report from a few years ago said lost money from unpaid meals represented a small part of a school food program's total spending. But situations are different. The School Nutrition Association says unpaid meal fees are a common issue. It said debt is increasing in places that started anti-lunch shaming policies. The debt is at about $90,000 in Cranston, Rhode Island. In January, officials there started using a debt collector. Michael Crudell is with Cranston Public Schools. He says simply getting a letter from a collection agency can sometimes get families to pay. He said parents' credit rating scores are not affected, but that letters are sent every 30 days until the school year ends. At that point, Crudell said, the district decides to pay the cost and the debt is canceled. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war. He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed. But the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich Agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.